Good evening, everybody. James McCanny here with My Science Hour for August 3rd, 2023. Many topics to cover tonight, but I'm going to concentrate on one, which is there's the recent movie, it's called Oppenheimer. And, of course, this is about the making of the atomic bomb. Now, I lived through this entire era, from the actual creation of the bomb and the use of it. I'm a little younger than that. I was born after World War II ended. But my entire youth was, our entire youth at that time was captivated, was dominated by Russia and the bomb. And of course, World War II had ended. The Germans had been completely obliterated down to nothing. The Japanese had been obliterated down to nothing, with the dropping of two atomic bombs, one on Hiroshima and the other one on Nagasaki, and, killing vast numbers of civilian population. And so that's part of the story, the history of the bomb, and those decisions were made by people. I hope I never have to make decisions like that, and you have to simply look at those things from a historical perspective. But anyway, I'm going to give you a perspective of the atomic bomb that I guarantee you've never heard before, because I've been myself at Los Alamos. I know what it's like. I know the people that work there. I know the attitude. I know, but anyway, I'll talk about that. And of course, I'm not divulging secrets. These are just some inside observations from having been there. I was invited to give a lecture on my work to probably about 50 of the world's top plasma physicists, and this includes the high energy group, etc., which is the atomic bomb groups. So anyway, also I'll be talking a little bit about comets and the H2, the atomic processes in comets. For example, comets create diamonds. How does a comet create diamonds on the sunward side? How are there X-rays? How are there even up to gamma rays on the big comets? And so these are nuclear level processes. And anyway, so I'm going to talk a little bit about that. First of all, a couple just news items here. Human footprints found in New Mexico. Now, this is not a news story. It's just hitting the mainstream media news recently, but for years a group of dedicated scientists, and a lot of times I criticize science and scientists, but this is really, really good work. I mean, this is sound archaeology, anthropology mixed together. Now, this is in the salt flats of New Mexico, so it's right here in our own backyard. These scientists, and there's many, many, so I'm not going to give any institutions that they're associated with because there's so many. They're working on this, but they have found embedded, now this is in rock. This is human footprints fossilized in rock alongside what they call the megafauna. So this would be the woolly mammoths, the saber-toothed tigers, the sloth, the big animals that existed prior to the Holocene, the change of the species, so to speak, a mass extinction worldwide. But it clearly shows human footprints alongside of these. And now there are things like seeds that they would find along with the human footprints. And they could date those, and along with understanding the fauna. Now, they knew when these plants grew, and so they can identify. They've also done DNA testing, and this relates also to the Inca. There's another story about the Inca, which I'll get into in a minute. But anyway, the extensive study shows conclusively that man, as we know him, man, modern man, just like you and me, was in the North American continent around 20,000 years ago. Now, this is phenomenal news for the people like myself who've been pounding this narrative for a long time, because there's huge amounts of evidence that for example, the Egyptian pyramids were not built by the pharaohs. That's just a fairy tale. In the Sphinx, there's all kinds of evidence that indicates that the history that we're taught could not possibly be true, especially, and I talked about this last week on my show, this fairy tale science that somehow man crescendoed in the Valley of Mesopotamia, you know, within the last 6,000-7,000 years, and all the races of man evolved from that group of people as they crawled over the mountains to the east and the west, and they, of course, lived in the beneficial area of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. But that couldn't possibly be true. And then, of course, the follow-on story is that man crossed the Bering Strait and then populated the Western Hemisphere. And then the Incas, the Maya, etc., are all subsequent generations of these people. Well, it just could not be true, because if it was 7,000 years ago, and of course, see what they do conveniently in this narrative is they eliminate any ability of ancient natural catastrophes, not the least of which is the Noah's Flood and the Venus event, the Velikovsky event, which I call it. Now, I have a 2-CD set, 18-hour lecture. It goes along with my books or the education package that you should listen to. This is a must-listen for all of my listeners. The education package contains it. It's a 2-CD set, 18 hours of MP3 lectures where I talk about it's called Planet X, The Physics of Ancient Celestial Disasters. That's the name of the 2-CD set. But it goes into Velikovsky. It talks about, puts him into perspective. It talks about Warner Sizemore, two lectures on that, where I actually interview Warner Sizemore, Warner finally passed away, a good friend for literally decades and decades of mine. He was the editor of the journal Kronos, which published my three-part comet paper, which is in the appendix of my book, Planet X, Comets and Earth Changes, that three-part comet paper unedited. And that gives my original statement after the Cornell years. I was at Cornell 79 to 81, and of course had some peer-reviewed publications in astrophysics journals until they slammed the door on me from publishing. I was on a roll. I had probably another 10 papers that were in review to be published, and literally had the door slammed on all of that work. And so subsequent to me leaving Cornell, I wrote this three-part comet paper as a summary of my work to establish the time, and that's where I predicted that comets would have X-rays to the sunward side, which was discovered in 1995 or 96, I forget, the discovery of the year. And of course, they gave credit to NASA, who discovered this by mistake. I had told them 10 years earlier to look for X-rays in comets, and they didn't do it. And so when it's finally discovered by accident, they take credit for it and then come up with some completely bogus reason, charge exchange. Anyway, I'm not going to get into that story tonight, but at any rate, getting back to the human footprints in New Mexico, wow, what an amazing story. So this is real science by real scientists who are doing extremely good work and not being politicized to include this some kind of narrative about the standard history and anthropology of man. Wow. So anyway, I will be covering that story some more in the future. Okay, another quick story here. Offshore wind businesses are taking a dive because the price of these things is going up. It's just like, remember when they started building nuclear power plants in the United States? The price, what they would say, oh, it's going to cost so many billions of dollars, $8 billion or something, which everybody knew in the business, the corrupt nuclear business, everybody knew that those price tags were false because they'd sell it to Congress and Congress would believe it because they're stupid. They're collectively stupid, individually and collectively, and they have no idea. You have these people that have no clue about science, and they're making de major decisions about science and energy, and and they're being influenced by people who are in the money world, and that's all it is. But anyway, remember when they would estimate that a nuclear power plant would cost $8 billion, something like that, and so the end result is that, of course, then they'd hit the cost overruns. Oops, and what are you going to do? You got a half-built nuclear power plant. Going to say, no, we're not going to put more money. So, of course, Congress puts more money into it, and then more money, then more money. Then it finally goes online. Or how about the San Onofre facility in California? One of the more recent builds in the United States is online for, what, a year or less? And they have major problems with this facility and just shut it down. It's just sitting there collecting dust. So anyway, this is happening now in the offshore wind business. These colossus, I should say, to use a word that's more, when we think of colossus, we think of Rome and big, and so the colossus offshore wind projects just falling flat on their face because of overruns in cost. So these projects are just like the nuclear power plant industry, where they're filled with graft and corruption and a system that does not work. A system that simply does not work. Now, you don't have to be a rocket scientist. And by the way, I've dealt directly with people like from the national energy consortiums, the government agencies, and they're just ignorant, stupid people. These are physicists. These are supposedly well-trained physicists, PhDs, in charge of our national weather programs, the national wind energy laboratories, etc. Stupid people. Ignorant people have no idea. And now here I'm going to tell you, the public, the problem. Take a look at one of those three-blade wind turbines, okay? And they're spinning rather slowly. And in a physics world, they're really not spinning at all. Their maximum velocity is about 16 revolutions per minute. So that's about every 3 seconds going around. That's pretty slow. I mean, that's real slow. And so you have a 30-mile-an-hour wind. That's their optimal wind speed, approximately, about 33 miles per hour wind speed. And the wind is just blowing through them. It's like one guy gave an example who understood this concept, and he said, imagine taking a big ship and putting those three long, hundreds and hundreds of feet long, three-blade wind turbine blades on a ship and expecting it to blow the ship down in the ocean and expecting it to make it move. Well, it's not going to happen because the wind, most of the wind just blows right by. If you have sails on a ship, you see that entire region above the deck covered with sail. Hello? Hello, Batman and Robin. This is not, I mean, it's just so absurd. But to think by any stretch of the imagination that somehow these things would work and produce energy is just, well, fairy tale, La La Land. That's the best thing you can say. And like I say, I've had conversations, and these people don't want to talk to me. No. Because their lunch ticket, excuse me, depends on them supporting this garbage. And so they want to, promote that, oh, that's the cutting edge, and they have college awards for students making advancements from engineering schools. All these people are walking around with stupid written all over their face because these things don't work. literally 95% of the wind blows through these things without ever touching the blades. How on earth could you generate energy doing this? But this is coming home to roost, because the second half of this industry is corruption monetarily. Because these businesses, GE, Siemens, Vestas, those are the big three, have really a monetary failure, even though they're highly, highly subsidized industries. So ask yourself this simple question. This is for these industries which employ thousands of, imagine all the engineers who are quietly sitting there collecting a paycheck at these companies, knowing full well that what they're selling doesn't work. It does not work. So at any rate, the second half of this is monetary, in that they're trying to sell this pig with lipstick to government agencies who are permitting. But finally, the cost overruns because of producing these behemoths is outstripping the ability of people to pay. And then the reality is where they put these in large numbers, XL Energy in the north, or go around the country and find any conglomerate government agencies that are permitting wind turbines onshore, including onshore, and they're a massive failure. And then they go running to the government. For example, XL Energy stopped maintaining its nuclear power plants to put money into three-blade wind turbine fields, thinking that was going to save them. And when it didn't, they went to the Minnesota government, the state government, asking for $2 billion to maintain their nuclear power plants. Well, if you look at their cash flow, they weren't saving money to maintain those power plants at, what is it, Monticello is one, and then Prairie Island is, there's two of them in Minnesota, and they weren't maintaining them. And plus, the national law requires them to put money aside from their earnings into a kitty, which is held nationally for their decommissioning of those facilities, and they never did it. So now they don't have money to shut them down, which is a big process. You can imagine shutting down a nuclear power plant and all the rigmarole that goes with it. But now, anyway, back to the story, offshore wind is falling flat on its face because of cost overruns, and this is before they even build them. So anyway, it's just insanity, and I'll just quick remind you that I invented something called the JMCC wing generator, which does work efficiently, and those people don't want anything to do with it. This is, it's here, we're in a world starving for energy, where energy is the top subject. Whenever you talk about anything, you buy a hot dog at the ballpark, and 95% of the money you pay for that hot dog is in the energy, because of energy cost. You can break it down, but 5% of the cost is for the hot dog. 95% of the cost, and this is if you go to the grocery store and buy an apple or an orange or a pineapple or whatever you do, 95% of the cost is in energy. Everything is just blanketed in energy cost. Oh my goodness. So at a time when we are desperate for energy, solar and three-blade wind turbines have become a complete failure. And as I said in my book, published in 2010, McCanny Wing Generator World Energy Project, with an addendum called The Myth of Alternative Energy. And in that addendum, I talk about the imminent failure of the three-blade wind turbine and solar energy industries, because they're junk. They don't work. They simply don't work. The only place that solar panels work is in the American Southwest, and even there, they're marginal. Okay, so at any rate, a quick mention, the MR5 whole house water filter, the best filter on the planet, stainless steel construction. And one, this was interesting, and I never thought about it. A woman wrote in, and she was going to buy one. And she said, is there any problem with this, you know, being crushed or anything like that? And I thought, you know, it's not really clear on the webpage, but these stainless steel containers are thick stainless steel. You would have to drive a tank, literally like a military tank, over it. And even then, you might have a hard time crushing it. So these things are really strong. It's going to be there long after your house. They can go outside if you're in a climate where it doesn't freeze. They can go outside. Or if you're in an area where it freezes, of course, they have to be inside. But they go at the point of entry of water in your house. And so I'm not going to talk about it. There's a lot of information on the sales page. Just go to the following URL, mymr5.com. That's five letters and digits. It's mymr5.com. And you go to the sales page, and all the information, there's frequently asked questions, there's ebooks, all kinds of information, so you understand if you need water softening, what do you do about that situation. Everything is there for you. So mymr5.com, go there. And this is an interesting story because I get to talk to customers because they're, you know, they call in and ask questions. And so I get to talk to some of these customers that the women call in and they go, I want to get this, but I got to convince my husband. It's like the husband is like, yeah, we've been drinking that water for 20 years and I ain't dead yet, so we don't need that water filter. You know, it's like, wow. And so the women are like, you know, I want to get this water filter because it's for health reasons. And, you know, in the case of women, they would like that husband to live a bit longer, you know, in spite of the cantankerous attitude. And some of these guys are doctors. I ain't kidding. Here you got a woman who's married to a doctor, and here's a doctor making, you know, a lot of money, whatever. Nah, we don't need that thing. Whoa, honey, excuse me. You know, anyway, I'm sorry but it just blows my mind that you have, and this is a very common thread that I see, but there's a lot of men out there that buy it too, and they realize the importance of clean water. But it amazes me the number of women that call in that are trying to convince their husband, and that's the stopping block. And I have kind of a funny story here. I'll just take a quick minute. When I went to college, it was a private school, and I had a full ride. I had a full scholarship. Everything was paid for because of academic scholarship. But there was a guy a couple years ahead of me, older than me. He was a poor kid, didn't have the scholarship, etc. So he sold vacuum cleaners. And I forget the brand of vacuum cleaner, but he went out and he never missed a sale. And then what they did is they had an incentivized program. And so he'd go to the house and he'd go door to door. He'd say, I'm selling. And that was back in the day when the vacuum salesman would go door to door, etc. Knock on the door. And he'd go in and vacuum, you know, he'd say, let me use your vacuum. And so he'd vacuum the floor, you know, the carpeting or whatever with the customer, potential customer's vacuum. And then he would go and vacuum and show all of what their vacuum missed. And that usually convinced him, but it was the same situation where the woman would say, I really want this. It's, you know, it's much easier to handle. A lot of these old vacuum cleaners were big and bulky and hard to manage and move around the house. And this guy had a really nice product. But it was the husband that didn't want to, he didn't want to spend that money on that darn vacuum cleaner. You know, this is the kind of guy that would buy his wife a pot, set of pots and pans for her birthday or for an anniversary, you know. But anyway, the guy didn't want to buy the vacuum. So what this, my friend, had was a little teeny chainsaw that they could sell to the, you know, would give to the guy free if they bought the vacuum. And he said that always convinced the guy because the guy got something. He got this little chainsaw. And he imagined him outside cutting down big trees with his little teeny chainsaw. But he said he always got the sale. And that's what it took to convince the husband, was that the husband got something out of the deal. Anyway, that's the same with the MR5 water filter. Some of these women call in I'm trying to convince my husband to get this. It's like, lady, you need clean water. You need it in the shower. That's where you get the royal dose of toxins every day. And you will live longer. You will be healthier. Oh, anyway, okay. Back to my dialogue here. I want to get right into this main science topic about there's the recent movie, The Making of the Bomb, Oppenheimer. But I want to give you my perspective of this, because when I was little, my dad had been in World War II. And of course, the Cold War was raging. After World War II, what they did in the government was they started the Cold War. They said, we can't trust those Russians. Of course, they split up Europe. The eastern part of Europe went to Russia, which was a very poor country after World War II. I mean, they had just been attacked twice by Germany, had depleted all their resources. They had Stalin and Lenin as dictators in place, just ravaging, mass starvation, moving populations, taking, this is part of the history of Ukraine, by the way, is taking the local populace out of Ukraine, moving in Russian population where they grew the crops, and people starving to death because these new people didn't know how to manage the farms. Oh my goodness, just insanity. So this is Russia. And of course, the United States goes, this is the big bad bear. We got to be eternally prepared. And of course, now you have nuclear bombs. Russia very soon had nuclear bombs. And this is something I learned being in the aerospace arena out in Los Angeles, where the international arms dealers, these are the big guys. These are the guys you never see or hear their names. And I got mixed in with these when I was looking for money for funding my magnetic propulsion systems for outer space. And so anyway, they would take technologies from the United States that were just recently developed because they were in the venture capital world. These are the guys that represented the families in the military-industrial complex, these nameless people who are still there. And this is why you're in the war in Ukraine, is because apparently Joe Biden just announced that we don't have any bullets left. They've used all the bullets in the reserve of the United States in Ukraine, shooting them into the air or shooting them wherever. And we don't have any bullets. Can you imagine? Can you even imagine this situation where the U.S. military does not have any bullets? But the Cold War has been raging, and of course, my parents, my mom was a bit smarter. She said, we never needed World War II. It was all a contrived war, and my parents lived through both World War I and World War II. They were born prior to World War I, and their parents were very much involved in World War I, but my dad was off in England in World War II. Working, he was a mechanic on B-17s. Okay, so anyway, after the war, the mentality of the populace, because back then there was three radio stations. You had the ABC, NBC, and maybe a third one. But that's where everybody got their news. So it was just like if you had CNN was the only outlet, or MSNBC. Imagine those are the only news outlets in the United States. That's the condition after World War II. And so people would turn on the radio, and that was the news. And all the little radio stations, the local stations, down to the little local town radio station, all retransmitted the news. They read the news that was given to them from the federal level. So that was the state that I grew up in. And when I started to school, I went to kindergarten and first grade. In first grade, immediately we were sequestered into diving under our desk because Russia was going to bomb us. And then within 15 minutes, you know, the local city, which would have been in that case Minneapolis and St. Paul, you know, quite a ways away, of course, but still, you know, the idea would be that the shockwave would blow all the windows out, and they scared the crap out of us, showing us videos. This is little kids. I'm a little kid. They scared the crap out of us by showing us videos of the atomic bomb going off and then, you know, houses being blown away and and we're supposed to dive under our desks, and that's supposed to protect us, Well, good grief, if there's a nuclear bomb going off, getting under your desk isn't going to help you. But that was the mentality, scare the crap out of the kids. And of course, the parents are completely involved in this Cold War narrative, and everybody hates Russia because Russia is bad and evil and horrible. And, but this was to keep the military industrial complex going and the nuclear energy industry and the bomb industry. So there was this race. You know, the Russians have no more nuclear warheads than we do, and on and on and on. But let's go back a few years to World War II. And where did the bomb come from? What is the real history of this? So let's go back to the very beginning. So it starts in around, really, the late 1800s. It actually goes back to Newton. It goes back to Isaac Newton, literally, because Newton did some experiments. He took light from the sun. He took a patch of light coming in from the sun, and that patch of light, he knew the measurement and the distance to the sun. And so the energy then they were able to convert into heat energy and then measure it. And so if you went back to the surface of the sun and imagine that the sun was like this big wood fire, big pile of wood burning, the chemical fire of burning wood or coal or the hottest thing, it would be coal would be the hottest thing we could burn from a chemical standpoint, which of course was known about in Newton's time, or oil was known about also. The hottest thing you could burn from a chemical fire was literally millions of times less than the energy coming off the surface of the sun. So back in the days of Newton, they already knew that there was something going on in the sun that we could not duplicate here. So they knew there was some kind of process, and they didn't know what it was. So all of that knowledge mitigated forward in time, all the way up into the 1700s, the 1800s, the late 1800s. There was activity. And remember, during this time, go back, there were the alchemists who thought that if they could change stone into gold, they would be wealthy. And there were all of these, and these were legitimate at the time. Legitimate questions. Can you take a rock and turn it into gold? And of course, they couldn't. They tried. But, okay, so all of the scientists are conscious of this. They're aware of this. And Albert Einstein, of course, is working in this time. And by the way, there's some controversy about Albert Einstein, things like that. That's all garbage. If you look what Einstein did, in not just one thing. I mean, if he did one thing, you'd say, oh, okay, whatever. This guy did lots of stuff in quantum physics and, general relativity, special relativity. In general relativity, the bending of light is not true. It's simply black holes, and there's no such thing. And Einstein knew that. He was a good scientist, and he was objective about his own work. He knew that general relativity didn't work. It was a big boondoggle pushed through by Eddington. Anyway, that's another story. But anyway, here's the attitude around the turn of the century, the early 1900s, is they're starting to discover quantum physics. The Bohr atom is established. They're starting to understand quantum physics and the wave nature of light. So wave dynamics are already well ingrained. You have the Hubble using telescopes with spectrometers for the first time, realizing and for the very first time, imaging galaxies, entire clusters, billions of stars, realizing that our star is in a galaxy. And then the redshift and the use of spectrometers and the classification of spectral analysis, etc., in stars, the classification of stars themselves relative to spectrum. All of this is going on, but in the background, of course, realizing that going all the way back to Newton, that there was some process on the sun, nuclear process, And of course, as we know today, that's fusion. That's the combination of hydrogen, deuterium, and the lower mass elements. Combining them, and there's a slight decrease in mass, and that is what changes into energy. And of course, I've done the mathematics on this as part of my study as a physicist. When you see the derivation of special relativity, and that's where this comes from, out pops this equation out the side. It's kind of like out the side. It's like you're doing the Lorentz transformations. You're doing the mathematics for with the speed of light being a constant in all frames of reference, and you're doing the mathematics, which it doesn't make sense in Newtonian physics. But to understand these quantum processes, and this is one of the things that Einstein did that nobody else could do or did do, is he unlocked these. I mean, he was a master at finding these subtle little things and simplifying them a lot of times down to a little equation. So out of the special relativity transformation equations, out the side, not out of the main construction, because you're dealing with things moving in relative frames of reference. What does that have to do with nuclear bombs? Well, out the side of all of this pops this equation, E equals mc squared. And it's really bizarre. I mean, when you look at it mathematically or in terms of physics, it's really a strange phenomenon to have this little equation kind of like pop out the side of somewhere and like, what's this? It's like the egg. It's like the dinosaur egg that pops out of, you know, out of a cave somewhere. It's really strange. But you get this equation equals mc squared, which gives you the conversion of mass. And so that little bit of mass change when you have a fusion reaction, or later they also discovered the fission of the heavy atomic elements, because they also knew at this time you had the Curies. You had the Curies running around the laboratory, and they were always already Nobel Prize candidates for their work on nuclear energy, because they realized in these heavy atoms, when they split apart, there was energy that was released. So experimentally, they already knew about the sun, okay, and they knew that the sun was hydrogen, okay, so there's a nuclear process involving hydrogen. Okay, then you have the other side of the atomic table is the heavy elements, and they are naturally decomposing into other components. And so this gets back to the alchemy, where you're actually creating new elements from one big atom is splitting apart because it's unstable. And of course, then they learned about the neutrons and the instability in the and then they also understood very basically about nuclear reactions, where the neutrons would come out at high energy and then hit another atom and cause that one to disintegrate into its component parts. So they understood all of these processes, basically just from observing nature. So now what they do is they apply Einstein's equation, E is equal to mc squared, and they realize the basis of nuclear energy. Okay, so now the cat's out of the bag. Einstein has his equation, which pops out of special relativity equations, which is dealing with transformations of movement of objects in space, has nothing to do with energy, has nothing to do with the atomic bomb, but does secretly. And so Einstein unlocks, and that's what Einstein did, is he put the key in the lock and opened the lock. It's like, remember the sword, what is it, the sword of Arthur? All these big knights, they said whoever takes the sword out of the rock will be king. And all these big knights are up there pulling on it and they can't get it out. And Arthur walks up there and it just slides right out of there. He becomes king. That's the story of Arthur becoming king of England. And it's the same kind of thing, is that Einstein did that in physics. He was the guy that, whether it was quantum physics, the charge on the electron, or the, you know, all kinds of other things, the photoelectric effect, What's so interesting is when finally they gave a Nobel Prize to Einstein, it was for the photoelectric effect, a very insignificant, relatively insignificant quantum effect of light. And he was able to put that into perspective and put very simple equations, but nobody else could do that. And it was very simple. He's the one who, and by the way, besides being a physicist, I'm a student of history of science. Because if you don't know the history of science, how are you going to have new creations, new science, etc.? You have to understand. So throughout my life, when I worked on problems, I knew what the big problems were. Comets, understanding them, understanding all the aspects of that, because that would tell us where planets came from, the formation of planets, and the actual fact that fusion is in the surface of the sun. It's up in the atmosphere, not on the inner core of some kind. You know, that's just bogus. That the core fusion model of the sun is completely bogus. The prime number work, if you look at the dozens of things that I did, discoveries that I made, it's because I knew what to work on. I knew what the big outstanding problems were, and everybody else was marching off down the wrong road somewhere else with government money and whatever. I didn't do that. I went off on my own because I knew the history of science. And I knew the things like that Einstein and Bohr and these other people did because they knew the problems to work on. You know, they knew the key things that, and like I say, they put the key in the lock and turned it. They were able to take the sword out of the rock. And that's the case with E equals MC squared. Okay, so now they have an equation. It's verified with physical processes that they can see. And this is, but they don't know the real process yet to make the bomb. In other words, take these processes that are natural and put them in a bottle of some kind and make them happen so we can, and of course, way back then, energy was a big issue. By then, the energy industry was in full swing. Remember that the very early automobiles were electric. They had liquid batteries, acid batteries, or other types of salt batteries that are just mixed with water. You could see these guys on a big car, six or eight guys on a car, and that was an early electric car. But they moved it because of the oil industry. They moved the production into gas-powered automobiles, and that's where Ford came in, the industrial revolution, the assembly line, all of that. And so the world moved into the world of petroleum. And I think at that early stage, they realized, yeah, there's enough of this stuff that we can run it forever. And so they took out the electric streetcars, you know, that whole history of moving everybody into the family car, removing public transportation. Okay, so that's another issue. That's a side topic that maybe some other time I'll talk about. Okay, so anyway, here we are in the Hitler is becoming powerful in Europe. Hitler is very interested in science and engineering. Germany is a powerhouse of intelligence, of engineering, of high tech, of everything that you would need. I mean, look at the military machine that Hitler built in a 10-year period. After World War One ended, they were decimated. Germany was a country floundering. It was a country without a rudder. And Hitler came to power, and these are just historical facts. It's not glorifying Hitler or whatever became a World War II or anything else. It's just a historical fact. Hitler organized, he took them off the international monetary standard, developed their own monetary standard, and that's where he realized that he needed an amazing army to defend against what was going to happen to him as he took Germany off of the international monetary standards and put them on their own monetary standard. So anyway, of course, World War II ensued, and Einstein wrote a letter, the famous letter to the president, that look, there's these processes, we know about them. Germany, and of course Einstein was from Germany, so he knew that the Germans were developing, they were working hard on rocketry. He knew about the German rocket programs, and he knew that they were working diligently to learn how to create bombs with nuclear weapons, to create nuclear weapons, because who controlled nuclear weapons would control the world, no question about it. I mean, and the United States proved that. In fact, when it finally dropped the bombs on Japan, the two bombs they dropped on Japan were very different types of bombs. They were not the same, and they wanted to give Japan the idea that they had an unlimited number of these. We can just drop one next week. That's why they dropped two. If they only dropped one, the Japan would say, well, they dropped their one bomb. Okay, now we're really pissed off and we're going to continue fighting. But they dropped two. And the second one was like, it was like, okay, they got lots of these. One too many. And so then at that point, Japan folded and said, okay, no more. We know that we're licked. And this was also the part of the movie plot is the behind the scene decision between Oppenheimer, who was really not a decision maker. He was a scientist. He was an engineer. He was a physicist on the, he was the head of the project at Los Alamos, which I'll get into here in a minute. Okay, so anyway, Einstein writes this letter, knows that the Germans are working on the bomb. And then the United States comes back and they gather up all the physicists from around the country and they ship them off to Los Alamos. And they create this city in the middle of the desert, in the middle, the most remote area, because at that time there was a potential for Japan attacking the West Coast. There was still that threat. So they had to get these guys out in the middle of nowhere. And when you drive out to Los Alamos, which I did, it is one of the most remote places on the planet. Like I've been in the middle of the Atacama Desert in Peru. I've been on other places around the world that are very remote. But let me tell you, Los Alamos is a remote place. So that's why they picked it. And you come up on it and it's like this, it was like, kind of like a college campus in the middle of nowhere. And of course, they have underground facilities and all of the everything they needed to work on the bomb. And they got all these brains together, the best physicists in the country. That's where Young Feynman was. Hans Bethe, who I met at Cornell, was on that group. And of course, Einstein. All of these people were part and parcel of this effort to learn how to develop the bomb. And it was like a self-defense type of thing, where if we didn't develop the bomb first and the Germans did, it was like, okay, everybody's speaking German from now on. And the war, the air war in Germany and in Europe was raging on. Europe or Germany was attacking Russia, had already consumed most of Europe. And then you had Franco in Spain, you had the Italian sector also of the alliance with Germany, and it was just the World War II was raging, the Pacific War was going on, and behind the scenes at Los Alamos, this little spot in the desert in the American Southwest, they are working feverishly to develop the bomb because that's the only way they can they understand that if Germany develops that thing, it's the gloves are off, it's over. Whoever develops the bomb first, and of course, historically, we know that Germany fell previous to anybody developing the bomb. The bomb came a bit later, not much. In terms of time, the US developed the bomb just a short time to a workable mechanism, a short time after Germany surrendered. Okay, so at any rate, you have the D-Day invasion, the physical war that's going on, but behind all of this, the development of the nuclear weapon program. And so they were very aware of hydrogen and the fusion bombs, what they called the A-bombs, and then the heavy metal or the heavy element bombs, the uranium. And by the way, this is where, like in St. Louis, they knew that they needed concentrated, large volumes of concentrated uranium, and putting it into a form that was bomb ready, where they moved it and processed it to plutonium. So the physics behind this I'm not going into, but all of this work is going on. And so, like I say, the two bombs that were dropped on Japan were very different in their construction, in their makeup. But, okay, so now I'm born, after World War II. The bombs had been dropped, civilian populations. That whole story is, it's just a page in history. So you have to study it for better, for worse. That's what happened. But it ended, and then at that point they said Japan can no longer have a military because these people are just nuts. They had already been attacking China. The Japanese were very, very militant group of people. And every time they got enough wherewithal, they would attack somebody, And of course, there's the issue of Pearl Harbor, where they were drawn into the attack. We know that the president at the time had a letter. In fact, that has been confirmed many ways, and also to me personally, people who knew that letter existed, stating that Japan was going to attack Pearl Harbor and setting up the situation, Nimitz taking the aircraft carriers out of Pearl Harbor and putting battleships in their place. And so when the Japanese came in, their map, they thought they were going in on the aircraft carriers and they were sinking battleships. And of course, my dad told me the story. He lived on a little farm. And by the time he got into town, there were the bands playing, there were the tables all set up, they were signing people up. And that day, 1 million young men signed up for military, whereas they couldn't get them before. Anyway, that's another piece of history. Okay, so now let's take a look at Los Alamos. And by the way, I want to complete a thought. I was talking about St. Louis, and there's a place up in Portland or in Oregon and in Washington State where they were cleaning uranium. They knew they needed high concentrations, bomb-grade uranium. And so the yellow cake, there were people out in the California mountains looking for uranium. A lot of people got rich finding uranium because they needed that to make the bombs. And so anyway, St. Louis still has very polluted areas. I know people that are in the St. Louis area who's cannot have animals on their farm. They all die of cancer because what they did is they cleaned the uranium, and there was still some uranium in the waste, which they just took out and dumped. And that got into the groundwater. Same way up in Washington State, they took it and they spread it on the fields, like with a spreader. And so a lot of areas up there are contaminated. Okay, so anyway, on to the discussion of Los Alamos itself. Wow, I could go on for quite a bit of time, but anyway, at the time when I went to Los Alamos, I was very well recognized in the entire Tier 1 science community. And if you want to remember, Tier 1 are the military level science. That's what I call real science. That's where they don't care about politics. They want the real story. Tier 2 is totally political. That's what you see, the Carl Sagans, the Neil deGrasse Tysons. The History Channel specials is Tier 3, Tier 4 outreach stuff where this is the garbage science passed off to you, to the public. But at the Los Alamos, it's reality. They are dealing with real science. And so anyway, at the time I was very active and well known in the scientific community. So they invited me to give a talk at Los Alamos. This is the top place in the world for somebody to go speak. And you're talking to not an audience, there's no news media, completely private. You're talking to the top physicists in the world, literally. And of course, they do interact also with other countries. I'll just put it that way. But you have a conglomeration of scientists from literally all over the world, but primarily the United States. What I saw were primarily, well, okay. But being invited is a big thing. That is a major, they don't just invite anybody, you know, to go talk there. And it was very interesting because they wanted to know about my science work. The drive out to Los Alamos, I already described that. It's just the most desolate area you can find. And I went with a girlfriend at the time, and she was a nurse. And what happened is the day I'm going out there, I developed this amazing toothache. I mean, it was flattening me to the ground. I could hardly move. And she went to the drugstore. I don't know what she got. It was like in a little tube, and I put it on that tooth, and it went away. Whatever it was, but it was a lifesaver for me because I was in severe pain. So anyway, I go off early in the morning to my talk, and my talk was like at like 2 in the afternoon or 1 in the afternoon, right after lunch. So the morning I spent with the High Energy Bomb Group, and these were like elderly gentlemen, rather small of stature, but dressed in literally World War II style clothes, with the little thin tie and kind of the plaid checkered shirt, and these really wide, you could hardly see their shoes, really wide wool pressed pants. And I mean, the World War II, these were literally in out of World War II people who had been there. They were still there. And they were doing high energy bomb death calculations. And that's where I learned, by the way, when I finally started doing hurricane death calculations, where they had these hurricanes come into Florida and destroy entire trailer courts, and all the people died. That's where I learned how to do the death calculations for those types of events. Okay, so the go eat lunch with a group of people, and then I go to the talk. And the meeting we had was in a very small room, and 50 people showed up. I mean, a lot of people showed up. And so they had to move it, and they had all the camera equipment set up to film my talk. But since we moved to a much bigger venue, the camera equipment, there was not time to move it, so it was not filmed. I later did a reconstruction of that talk, and you can see that on my DVD, in my DVD section. And I'm going to have to continue this next week, because literally I'll fill the whole next show with the discussion of Los Alamos, and it's a very interesting story. So tune in next week, and just remember, go to the sales page for the MR5. It's mymr5.com. Very good prices. We're keeping these prices low so people can afford these. mymr5.com or jmccwaterfilters.com. And I will talk to you next week. This is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we're at the crossroads. Good night.